You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week we visit the Kew Bridge Steam Museum. We look at pirate radio around the world in Ireland, Spain, London and the USA. Does digital compact cassette sound as good as CD? The results of some tests. Should Channel 5 television wait and be digital? Listen to Radio Wimbledon. And we ask, will the quality of ITV programmes suffer in the coming years? Plus your letters, that's Sparks.
Listening to Sparks on Radio Facts 3910 6205 and 12255. This week we're in Kew in London. That's the west of London, and we're at the Kew Bridge Steam Museum, which used to be a water pumping works owned by Thames Water and is now a museum which celebrates in old steam engines. And they've also got a museum of London's water supply. There are five giant Cornish pumping engines and other rare steam engines, and today we're going to be having a look round. This is at the top of probably the biggest steam engine. It's called the Maudsley, and it's difficult to describe how big it is, apart from to say it's about the size of a house. There's a large water pumping section which I'm standing next to, and at the other end is the steam cylinder. There it goes. We'll go down and have a look at the piston in a minute. This is the bottom of the cylinder, which I can walk right round, and there's a man controlling the thing. of copper pipes and controls and dials, and we're actually standing right in the middle of this engine. Walk over to the water pumping section. Started work in August of 1838 and first pumped in Paddington, and then it worked until April of 1944. It's called Maudsley because it was made by Maudsley and Sons of Lambeth, and it's a 65-inch diameter cylinder engine with an 8-foot stroke and a pump pole 28 inches in diameter, and each stroke it pumps 136 gallons, that is 2.5 million gallons every 24 hours. It's the first engine to pump water from the Kew Bridge Works, and between 1846 and 1848 extensive alterations were made to it, and a new cylinder and piston was made for it in 1860. I'm talking to David Pelvin, who's currently operating the Maudsley engine. Oh, he's just dropped his cigarette. I hope I'm not disturbing you too much. These levers in front of you, I've been noticing while you've been working it, that occasionally you have to sort of touch them and bring them down into line. Is this something an operator would normally have had to do when it was working in the...
This one hasn't actually run for a fortnight now, so it's the first run of the day. It does tend to be a little bit erratic at times, but hopefully it will settle down on the next run.
So you're just guiding it because it's not quite falling back when it should.
Normally the operator will purely regulate the steam valve to compensate for any variations in boiler pressure.
Uh-huh. How many people would be manning this? Would have been manning this sort of site in the 19th century? Do you know?
Not an exact figure, but it was, bearing in mind it would run 24 hours a day. Mm. You had a driver for each engine, plus an oiler. You had up to 14 coal-fired boilers, which needed firing, plus coal trimmers for shifting the coal about, and plus no doubt a clerical staff, so I would say quite a large number of people were involved.
So the engine's really happier working 24 hours, it doesn't really like being started and stopped?
That's right, I think since the these engines have been restored, they've probably been started and stopped more times than they ever were in their working life.
Yeah.
They were designed to run 24 hours a day for, say, 3 months at a time.
So how long would it take from cold to get this built up enough steam and going to ready to start?
Well, this one, it takes roughly just over an hour to warm through before it can be started. The 90-inch, which is bigger than this, that takes nearly 2 hours to warm through.
Wow. Okay, that's fascinating. Thanks very much. Okay. We've come outside now, hopefully to climb up the tower, which is a tower open day. This tower is hundreds of feet tall, and it used to be used to provide a constant pressure for the engines to pump into, and also to provide a constant pressure for the water mains.
Now, are you fit and healthy?
I am.
The interrogation.
Yeah. 270 steps, here we go. We're inside a dimly lit brick building with huge pipes going up and down it. And before I get out of breath, I'll tell you a bit more about this tower. It says it's 235 feet, that's just the pipes. Yes. The tower was built in 1867 to replace an earlier lattice structure. It stands 198 feet high, got the height finally, and was restored to its present clean and tidy state 15 months ago. And we're getting out of breath already. I'll stop the tape and talk to you when I've got my breath back. Just up the steps, we've met Dave Johns, who is another RadioFX presenter. What a coincidence. So what are you doing here?
Well, just, you know, thought I'd come along to have a look at the view. 261 steps just on my way down. It's pretty fantastic up there and very windy. The most amazing view.
We're on our way up. How did you hear about this place?
I read it in the Kingston Guardian, I think. It said open day with the tower open, and I thought I'll go along to that. I don't get out enough, I thought. Sitting in these little radio studios, I should get some fresh air. And here I am. And here you are.
It was a bit too windy to talk into the microphone up the top, but it's an amazing view. And in this hall is the 90-inch and 100-inch cylinder engines. The 100 is the biggest in the world, I think. We're walking inside it at the moment, virtually. Huge piston and some huge spanners to go with it. This one isn't going at the moment. You can hear the hissing in the background of the 90-inch one.
I find that totally disturbing, the way that two can go around. She doesn't like it, my brother. It's like one of those things you look at when you see them going away and suddenly going back in again. See, they have a high-tech baked bean pan attached to it.
This is one of the most noisy ones, Haythorn Davy triple expansion engine in green. You can hear the noise of all the valves opening and closing. You're listening to Sparks on RadioFax 3910, 6205 and 12255. And this week we're coming from the Kew Bridge Engines Trust, which is just off Kew Bridge. It's near Chiswick in near Brentford in West London. It's just around the North Circular off the River Thames. It's a steam engine museum.
And if you go to visit that in Kew, just down the road, a couple of hundred yards in fact, is a marvellous little musical museum, which has got no end of mechanical instruments in it, from the simple to the very complex. They had little handheld wind-up things, to through to player pianos, player grand pianos, and also a Wurlitzer, in its full glory, with all the sound effects and so on associated with it. And I'll play some bits and pieces that I recorded there.
Thank you.
You either get popular tunes on these or patriotic tunes. Mm. The fun sort of patriotic sound.
Some of the delights in store for you at the Q Musical Museum. And now to some other sort of windbags, the DTI. They've written to the editor of Shortwave magazine, and it's published in the Off the Record column. The edition of Off the Record has been heavily curtailed following some heavy interest by the Radio Communications Agency. Fraser Murray of the RIS wrote to the editor saying, "My attention has been drawn to an article by Andy Cadier in your October 1991 edition entitled Pirates Off the Record. Mr. Cadier lists several stations operating in the HF band. The Radio Communication Agency views with great seriousness the misuse by an irresponsible minority of frequencies in the frequency bands assigned exclusively to the Maritime Mobile and Aeronautical Services. As a licensed radio amateur yourself, you will understand the need for frequency use to be planned and adhered to, especially where the authorised use has implications for the safety of life. The agency has published extensively its concern at the unauthorised use of the HF band, and has reinforced this concern with several successful prosecutions. Moreover, the unauthorised use of this part of the spectrum has brought formal complaints from other overseas administrations. Let us be under no illusion. They can and do cause potentially harmful interference to the authorised uses of radios. Furthermore, I read in Mr. Cadier's column in the January 1992 edition that he proposes to publish a list of FM pirates. You and he should both be aware that under Section 1C it is an offence to publish the times or other details of any unauthorised broadcasts made by a pirate broadcaster. The maximum penalty for this offence is an unlimited fine and or 2 years imprisonment. It is our policy to prosecute in respect of unauthorised broadcasting offences. Perhaps you would give the matter some consideration before publishing another article of this nature." And the editor, to his credit, says, "Is it illegal to publish reports of broadcasts that have been made, which is what this column has been doing, or is this sort of report just as bad in the eyes of the Radio Communication Agency as printing a schedule for the next few weeks? If we're not allowed to listen to pirate stations, then how do we tell which station is a pirate and which is legitimate? Are the many anti-government stations active in the Third World countries pirates? This column will try to meet your needs in the future, albeit in a changed way." So writes the editor of Shortwave magazine, Dick Ganderton. And Andy Cadier has written, saying, "As a contributor, I wish to thank you personally for your valuable assistance in providing information for the pirate page. Personally, I cannot see the DTI allowing the magazine to produce even a watered-down column of this nature. There is, of course, the possibility of getting a non-British magazine to carry the series. I would suggest you stop sending any contributions, but if you have any views, to send them to the editor of Shortwave magazine." So, we have... "Dear Mr. Ganderton, I gather that you have received representations from the Radio Communications Agency regarding the future of the Off the Record feature. Doubtless, what you have been sent will have been very carefully worded. You have to distinguish between two things. Reporting factual information about events which occur is in no way unlawful. Publicising something which somebody is planning might be different. I would urge you to reply robustly to the DTI and assure them that your editorial review ensures that what is published complies with the laws of the land. There is a world of difference between threatening legal action and actually taking it. In the very unlikely event you were actually summoned, your specialist magazine would immediately become a cause célèbre in the general media, and you would gather a great number of powerful friends. Of course, in terms of the law, you're not even reporting on a pirate station until it has found to be so by a court. So, if you'd like to write a similar letter, I think it's an excellent idea, and you can address it to Dick Ganderton, the editor of Shortwave magazine, in Inefco House, The Key, Pool, Dorset, BH15 1PP. That's Dick Ganderton, the editor of Shortwave magazine, Inefco House, that's Inefco House, The Key, as in poolside key, Pool, P-O-O-L-E, in Dorset, BH15 1PP.
You've done it all. You've broken every code. Appalled the rebel to the floor. You spoke the game, no matter what you say. But only metal, what a ball. There's nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's hard to smile. Resist, resist. Yourself, you have to hide. Oh, come up and see me to make me smile. I'll do what you want, run away wild. There ain't no more, you've taken everything from my belief in Mother Earth. Can you ignore my faith in everything? 'Cause I know what faith is and what it's worth. Away, away. Don't say, maybe you'll try. Oh, to come up and see me, to make me smile. I'll do what you want, just run away.
Report on UK home video taping. One illegal copy is made for every 4.2 pre-recorded videotapes purchased. So says a Harris Research Centre survey conducted in the UK on behalf of Macrovision. As many as one in every 14 VCR users admitted copying pre-recorded video cassettes, equivalent to more than 1 million households. According to the Harris team, 82% of those questioned knew it was illegal to copy pre-recorded videos, which may suggest the true extent of illegal copying is even greater. In the survey, 20% of the 500 VCR owners telephoned admitted to having unauthorised copies in their possession. The results suggest there is little discrimination in the type of material likely to be copied by individuals. Most subject categories are vulnerable, the most popular being children's films, 42%, and recent movies, 42%. These are followed by cartoons, 34%, old films, 30%, music videos, 29%, sport, 25%, and exercise at 12%. At a press conference to highlight the problem, Norman Abbott, Director General of the British Videogram Association, said copyright owners are naturally reluctant to investigate and prosecute amateur, non-commercial copiers who operate in their own homes. This makes it all the more important for the product to be protected from the activities of such infringers by technical means, like Macrovision copy protection. Speaking on behalf of the Macrovision Corporation, US President Joe Swite said, "We wanted to find out the level of home copying of pre-recorded video cassettes in the UK, and also to quantify the effect of this copying on the rental and sell-through markets. I believe that the resultant study is the most comprehensive of its kind undertaken in the UK, and it has certainly come up with some eye-opening facts and figures. Also revealed by the study is the fact that multiple VCR owners are almost four times as likely to copy as single VCR owners, and that UK households have on average 2.3 unauthorised copies in their libraries. This suggests the total number of illegal copies in the UK exceeds 33 million. On a brighter note, 44% of home copiers said they would have rented the last tape they copied if they had been unable to copy it, and two-thirds said they would have been prepared to buy the videotape under the same circumstances had they known it was commercially available. A report there aimed at getting video duplicating houses interested in buying copy protection schemes published in One to One magazine.
A magazine that's come through to us recently is called FRS Goes DX. You may have heard the Dutch station FRS Free Radio Service on the 48-metre band. They were on a few Sundays ago, in fact. It's a very thick magazine and with lots of useful information in. And I'll read you some excerpts, including things about pirate radio around the world. Ever heard of the DMX system? It stands for Digital Music Express. In the home of commercial radio, the USA, it has become clear that listeners are willing to pay for non-stop music without any interruptions. Compare it with Sky Radio minus the commercials. Scientific Atlanta developed the necessary equipment for the DBX system. The package contains no less than 30 different music channels, and the audio quality is more than impressing. From Atlanta, DBX reaches Europe via an Intelsat satellite. Currently, DBX is only available to cable networks, but can't be excluded that the system will also be available for private reception. That means the necessary equipment must come onto the market. Remarkable is the remote control being part of the DBX system. An LCD display shows the artist and title. And later on in the magazine, Free Radio in Spain. The old town centre of Gijón, twisting alleyways, dark houses, small bars. In the air, not only the smell of baked sardines, but also the presence of free radio stations. These emanate from Radio KRAS, an unlicensed VHF station. The name stands for Collective Radio of Osteria. Osteria is the name of the county in which Gijón, a large industrial city at Spain's Atlantic coast, is laid. When walking through Gijón, or Exixon as it's called in Austria, one cannot help noticing large yellow stickers. They embellish waste containers, transformer or street name shields. On it, it says Radio Caras, 105 FM. Curiosity is raised and Spanish friends take care of getting us into an old house in the city centre, from which Radio Caras broadcasts. Hardly are we in the studio when we're sitting in front of a microphone to report live on the free radio scene in Germany. Jorge, who happens to be present to present this programme, learns with astonishment that there are only a couple of active political stations with us, and that many more free radios only provide music. For Radio Caras, radio means more, a female co-operator explains. Radio is for spreading and exchanging of information, as well as the support of public relations. It's also an expression of the human rights. Community radio is an expedient for education and cultural expression. Alas, the communication is somewhat difficult, as we of Radio Peace in Action do not speak that much Spanish, and they speak only Spanish, but notwithstanding that, an almost two-hour discussion takes place after the interview. They go on to say about the studio, and the station is financed by around 100 supporters, and surprisingly also by the municipality of Gijón, notwithstanding that the city fathers are often criticised by the radio station. But that city is not giving the money for the radio, but for the cultural programmes that Radio Caras is carrying out. Concerts by independent Spanish groups are organised, and the Asturian language is propagated. However, this leads to discussions in the radio collective, because for some of them, the co-operators Asturian is too nationalistic, and they see themselves more as Europeans. And that's an interesting station. They see themselves as political radio, not only local but also nationwide. Themes like unemployment, women problems, hostility towards foreigners, or the possible resignation from NATO by Spain are taken up. There are also programmes looking critically at bullfights. Broadcasts are mostly live, but there is also a common program bank with other free radio, so that an exchange can take place. On things like jingles or sound effects, no value is set. More important for Radio Caras is the political testimony. There are also no commercials on the radio. Independent record labels sporadically supply the station with records, but most of the time they're by Basque groups that cannot be understood in Asturia. There's also a small record library at their disposal, so every program maker has to bring his own music along. It's a station mainly for and by young people. They seek the direct contact with the listener. A telephone line is available at any moment to bring the caller to air. And you could write to them. However, you should only do it in Spanish, so I don't know whether it's worth giving out the address. And free radio in the United States, by Andrew Yoder. European pirates primarily use home-built rigs that run 20 to 50 watts output, say, from a 12-volt battery. I don't think I've ever heard of a European station that uses an amateur radio transmitter. By contrast, nearly every pirate transmitter in North America, on shortwave at least, was originally intended for amateur use. The most popular brands are Heathkit, Johnson, Allied, Knight, Kenwood and Yaesu, mostly from the 50s and 60s. 1970s for Kenwood and Yaesu. Most pirates use these transmitters because they're relatively inexpensive, reliable, and most use AM modulation only. Off the top of my head, I can only think of one or two stations over here that ever used homemade equipment. This brings me to my first question. Why don't European stations use amateur transmitters? Did too few transmitters exist after World War II in the 1950s? Are these transmitters more expensive in Europe? In the United States and Canada, a typical Heath DX60 transmitter, 25 watts AM output, grid modulated with a single 6146 final tube made in the 1960s, costs anywhere from $25. That's approximately £12 in working condition. Well, I think that answers the question. They are cheaper in the United States. Johnson Viking 2 transmitters have been used by a number of US pirates, including CSIC, RFM, WKND, East Coast Pirate Radio, Liberty, Radio USA, Cranker Radio, etc. Just about every station in North America has used the Heath DX60, or the Knight T60, I think. An interesting phenomenon is the effect of history and nostalgia. A few years ago, these hulking AM modulation rigs were basically worthless to hams, but a few die-hard hams clung onto the AM mode through the SSB trends of the 1960s and 70s. These guys and pirates have been trying for years to save some of these old radios from being thrown out with the garbage. Now guess what? People are starting to collect old radios as antiques, or at least as collectibles. Many of the best-sounding, highest-powered old transmitters are hard to find. Some of these classic transmitters are still on the air. A bunch of people who own these types of radio congregate near 3885 in our amateur band. These guys all operate legally, but they have their audio up to broadcast quality. To top it off, many of these guys have worked as engineers at legal radio stations. And many have good stories about broadcasting, and also about how to troubleshoot old transmitters that the pirates often use. And some American pirate frequencies are WRMR 1620, Hope Radio on 1620, 1775 and 3470, RFM on 6240, Cranker Radio on 6250, RFM on 6280, RF New England 6910, Hope Radio 7380, Radio USA 7385, RFM 7390, KMCR 7425, Radio USA 7490, RFM 7490, CSIC 7516 and 7525, WSKY 7550, Radio USA 7550, RFM 11400, RFM 12255, Radio USA 14480, Radio USA 21468 and 21490, Hope Radio 21750 and Amiga Radio 2600 kilohertz, 26 megahertz exactly. That's some information from the FRX Goes DX magazine, an excellent Dutch magazine, and an annual subscription to that costs £8 in Europe, and payments are accepted in cash or by Euro check or by postal order. And sample copies are 3 international reply coupons or £1 in cash. And you can write to them at FRS Goes DX, P.O. Box 2727, 6049 ZG Herten in the Netherlands. That's FRS Goes DX, P.O. Box 2727, 6049 ZG Herten, H-E-R-T-E-N, in the Netherlands. And a fascinating magazine. I hope they send some more of them for us to review.
Here's part of an article about mastering for the new digital compact cassette format, DCC in practice. Reporting from Polygram in Amersfoort in the Netherlands. This is the piece discussing the comparison of sound quality of DCC and CDs. Unlike analog duplicating, which can seriously affect the final quality of the sound if done poorly, DCC, being digital, does not basically suffer with this problem. Either you have the data and it is correct, or you don't have it. Of course, you can lose data by sloppy work practices during mastering or duplication, but there are no grey areas when it comes to degrees of sound quality. What is transferred from the CD U-matic master to the DCC master is the sound you'll eventually hear on the pre-recorded DCC cassette. So does this mean that DCC will sound like CD? Well, not exactly. It's not that simple. Because of the limited data storage area available on the DCC tape, there is a crucial process necessary in order to reduce the total amount of data that is transferred to the DCC tape. This is the PASC, or PASC, coding. It is extremely clever technology that attempts to do the impossible. When transferring the CD master to DCC, it analyses the sound, removes any part of the signal which it feels will be inaudible, then passes the final signal to the DCC master. How successful this processing is, has been, and continues to be of great interest to PolyGram. In fact, they take it very seriously. Many listening tests have been conducted by PolyGram, and in order to make their listening assessments even more stringent, the company is building a special listening facility. It's not a half-hearted effort either. At the time of my visit, construction was already well underway, and I was able to see the extensive acoustic shaping that was going into the basic construction of the floor, walls and ceiling. All of this will be hidden, of course, when the room is finally finished. But the room should be every bit as good as a modern recording studio control room, which is probably not surprising, as the room has been designed by a top international studio designer. For the time being, tests are conducted in a temporary room further down the corridor. Here, in a relaxed atmosphere with subdued lighting, listeners are invited to tell whether or not they can distinguish the sound of DCC from compact disc. Hans-Dieter Sommer, PolyGram's quality assurance manager, explains, "The difficulty with listening tests is always that they are subjective, and if there is a difference in the technical nature of the systems, people will always say there is a difference in the sound. We have now collected some comments and improved on the first versions of the DCC recorder, but we are still in the process of improvement. Nowadays, we are good enough to say the differences are very, very small, if there are any differences noticed by individual listeners. From a statistical point of view, I think there is no difference. The test is quite simple. You choose a CD, sit in front of the speakers, and listen to the sound. You can listen to any part of the music and take as long as you like. In front of you is a box with six buttons. They are arranged in two rows, each with three buttons. The top row enables you to switch between three sound sources. Two are the CD, and the other one is digital compact cassette. When you have decided which button is DCC, you simply press the equivalent button on the bottom row, then move on to the next sample. The test is repeated with 20 music samples. At the end of your test, your selections are compared with the actual switching pattern used during the test. If you score 20 out of 20, you can obviously hear a difference. If you score 0 out of 20, you obviously can't. According to Sommer, you need to score at least 12 or 13 correct responses to be statistically better than chance. Some people tested know immediately what X is, or think that they know, but others may need 5 minutes. How well did I do? I failed miserably. I couldn't hear any differences I could be certain of, which is either a credit to DCC, or I'm going deaf quicker than I suspected. I did, however, get a small reprieve. PolyGram gave me a copy of their specially recorded CD, which contains matching CD and DCC music samples. In the comfort of my own living room, and using some very expensive electrostatic headphones, I could hear a difference. It had little to do with whether or not I could hear the cymbals or bass drum on the DCC sample, but more a feeling that the musical sounds were more open and ambient with CD. Even so, given what was going on with the DCC processing, it is difficult to imagine the majority of users being disappointed in the sound of DCC. PolyGram feel the system is now very good, and with the work still being done, even some of the more critical listeners may find it increasingly difficult to get a perfect 2020 score, or even do better than chance. Some details there of what PolyGram is up to with DCC, reported by Carl Snape in One to One, the magazine for mastering, pressing and duplicating.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts every Monday and Tuesday. It's our look at science, technology and media news. And here's Peter Verbruggen's letter from Free Radio Society Holland, FRS. I heard Radio Facts already a couple of years ago during the Easter weekend, when transmissions ran for 4 days. Then transmissions started from Ireland and were finished because of the new Irish Broadcasting Bill. It was with great enthusiasm that I discovered that Fax was back on air last year. In my opinion, you're doing a great job. It's become almost a habit for me to tune in and listen to Fax before I go to sleep. My Sony ICF 2001D is next to my bed and I've stored 6205 and 3910 in the receiver's memory. One of my favourite shows is Sparks because it always contains interesting technical features and media news, but also musical wise, Fax is worth listening to. Did you know FRS carried out a kind of test on 3910 back in September 1991? Well, thanks for the letter, Peter Verbruggen. He's from Holland, the FRS Free Radio Society.
Oh, DC 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483-275-997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
A strange headline in World Broadcast News, which has nothing to do with Clive Sinclair. C5 Chariot takes new turn. Independent Television Commission Chairman George Russell has admitted for the first time that a licence for the beleaguered Channel 5 may not be awarded at all unless a workable and affordable solution is found to the vexed question of VCR retuning. If we don't award a licence, there's a solution available a little further down the road, said Russell. Digital TV is on the way, and in 5 to 10 years' time, digital transmissions on the Channel 5 wavelengths would avoid the need for retuning altogether. Delivering the 1992 Fleming Memorial Lecture for the Royal Television Society, Russell spoke convincingly of the catastrophic effects caused by the interfering signals. They black out your television screen, was his unambiguous verdict. An estimated 2.5 million VCRs, all nominally tuned to frequency channel 36, would be affected in areas where wavelength scarcity has forced Channel 5 transmission planners to select channels 35 or 37. The total would have been far higher, but for a late amendment to the 1990 Broadcasting Act, forcing viewers interested in the new channel to bear their own retuning costs. A series of concessions on programme quality and coverage obligations has subsequently changed the channel's identity from what should have been a close copy of the regional Channel 3, formerly ITV franchises, taking effect next January, to something resembling the early days of satellite television. Continuing uncertainty over the retuning issue forced the Commission to abandon plans to advertise the single licence in January, while guidelines were rewritten. A weighty tome was prepared to accompany advertising scheduled for 3rd of April, but then pulled at a late notice amid fears that the general election would starve the troubled channel of much-needed publicity. There is little doubt that Channel 5 has become a millstone around the neck of the streamlined ITC, which is due to move from its IBA predecessor's expensive premises opposite Harrods in London's fashionable Kensington to save money. I have to admit that when we move out of Brompton Road, I'm tempted to turn the ITC into the first ex-directory regulatory body, quipped Russell. That report by Richard Dean.
In the immediate vicinity of Wimbledon in South London, on 101.6, there's an all-tennis radio station. And I went to have a listen to it, and this is what I recorded from about 5 miles away, so the quality is not perfect.
Well, why? Good to be there. Contacts in China that we managed to get last year, we thought that that went up to about 500 million. My colleague John Barrett of the BBC, he has a further estimate now that we've got a new contract to put it up on the satellite based in Hong Kong that reaches half the world's population and that covers a satellite footprint from Egypt to Japan and from Mongolia to Indonesia. He thinks that it's near a billion and a half. No, that, I can't imagine. I mean,
mind-boggling,
no
isn't it?
No.
Ian, thank you very much indeed. That's Ian Edwards, who's the All England Lawn Tennis Club's television marketing director. Now, to the other end of the scale completely, because Chris Bowers is out and about once more, and he's found himself a ball boy and ball girl to talk to.
I have indeed, Cheryl, yes. I'm standing just by the entrance to the ball boys, ball girls position, right next to the competitors' entrance, actually, between courts number one and two. And I have here James and Karen. How old are you, James?
14.
Right, and Karen?
15.
Right, now you're both on centre court, yes? James Barrett and Karen. I didn't pick up your surname, Karen.
Loise.
Right, thank you very much for chatting. It's you do a great job. It's great fun watching you, and obviously it's the fact that you do your job so well means that we don't notice you a great deal. Hope you enjoy the rest of the championships, and back to you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, and of course we all greatly admire the work the ball boys and girls do. No Wimbledon would be complete without them. Welcome at a quarter to 11 to Radio Wimbledon, broadcasting on 101.6 FM. Well, having looked at the national papers, Bernadette Courtney is now having a look at her paper. And on the fine day's tennis, hopefully to be enjoyed by all queuing and all about to come in. Just to let you know that, in fact, if you are already in the complex, if you rush now to court number 10, you can see Ivan Lendl practicing with his coach, Tony Roach. Has one of the more illustrious practice partners, the reigning champion, Michael Stick. So you can see two great chaps for the price of one at the moment. That's court number 10. Head there now and see Lendl and Stick having a practice. And in terms of the leg stakes, I have to agree with Sue, we were just saying that really his legs are pretty fine as well, aren't they?
Yeah, he's in great shape. He's mad on fitness, of course, and he's always kept himself in very good shape. We ought to have a survey, you know, Cheryl, as to the 10 best ranked legs in the championships.
Well, I'm working on it. I have my own personal list, but it hasn't got to 10 yet, I'm afraid.
Oh, right.
Once you find a pair you really like, it's difficult to move on to another, really. But I have to say, looking at Lendl now out there, he's they're all pretty fine specimens, aren't they?
They certainly are.
There's going to be 600 centre court tickets sold today. 600 seats sold for number two and number one courts, and there's no portable telephones around the courts allowed at all. And if you do come in to listen to Radio Wimbledon as well as enjoy your match that you're sitting in on, please make sure you keep the volume down, of course, for the benefit of your neighbours. Now, of course, we are broadcasting live coverage of matches and details of matches in progress, so really you should be tuned in to us throughout your visit to the championships. And if you've come without a radio, you can in fact buy one at the Octagon, where we share a stand with Radio 5. You can buy one complete with batteries for £10. Of course, then you have yourself a portable that you can take home with you and use for other things. But certainly while you're here, stay tuned into Radio Wimbledon for full comprehensive coverage of the 1992 championships.
This week on Sparks, we visit the Kew Bridge Steam Museum,
pirate radio around the world in Ireland, Spain, London and the USA. Does digital compact cassette sound as good as CD? The results of some tests. Should Channel 5 TV wait and be digital? You're listening to Radio Wimbledon. Will the quality of ITV programmes suffer in the coming years? And the DTI tries to censor shortwave magazine. That's all in this week's programme.
That was Fleetwood Mac.
The news at 11 o'clock. This is David Bellin.
The DTI steps up its illegal microphone fight. In a campaign of increasing pressure from the Department of Trade and Industry, warnings have been issued recently to several international artists about the use of illegal radio microphone systems. Brian Copsey of DTI-appointed UK licensing body ASP Frequency Management said that a factor behind more rigorous enforcement was the allocation of frequency band Channel 35 to the fifth television channel from April 1993. Channel 35 was previously used for radio microphone systems. The changeover makes the use of Channel 35 for radio mics illegal in many regions of the UK, and also futile, as the television transmitter would override any microphone signals. Copsey said that the new Channel 69 for radio microphones featured a pioneering arrangement whereby radio systems could transmit at any frequency in the allocated band. Previously, licences were given for spot frequencies that rendered a fixed number of channels within the permitted band. But some technicians are warning that there are serious limitations to the new frequency allocations and are planning for more time to bring systems into line. Raycom Managing Director Ray Withers, whose clients include major rock artists, said he often had to change the operating frequencies of radio systems belonging to visiting American acts, as the usable US frequencies clashed with cellular phone services in the UK. However, if he moved US band's equipment into legal UK frequencies, they would then encounter similar problems in other European countries. Bands were pulling their hair out, he said. Copsey is also the chairman of the ETSI Resolution 8 Working Party, which aims to develop pan-European standards for the equipment itself. He pointed out that licensed bands for radio microphones were different in every European country. The changes in UK legislation were not a willful step out of line with the rest of the EC. Realistically, the changes of EC standard radio microphone frequencies before the year 2000 are virtually non-existent. Until then, the only viable option is likely to be licensing and operating the approved equipment in the country concerned. There are a number of paradoxes here, as Copsey pointed out. It is an offence to use a transmitter without a licence. This could mean that an artist using an unlicensed system was liable for prosecution, even though the licence should be obtained by the venue rather than the user. But hire companies run under a different set of rules again. Here, ASP issues them with a licence for a particular frequency. The hire company must then supply a permit to every client that will be using its equipment on the licensed frequency. The ever-complex bureaucracy, living off the back of licensing 50-milliwatt radio microphone transmitters, described there by Simon Croft in ProSound News Europe.
James Robinson writes to us from Oxton in Birkenhead. Hello again. This time I've made an interesting observation regarding Classic FM. Firstly, I received the Rutum transmitter on 100.9 when I was in Hereford on 3rd of June, the day after Wenvo started its tests. Gradually, every few days, transmitters have been switched on around the country, the last being today. For half an hour at a time, there are bird noises broadcast. After this, some test tones interspersed by announcements by a former GWR presenter. The bird noises are not, however, just bird noises. While listening, I also heard amongst the birds, hens, sheep, a dog, another dog that sounded like a fox, an aeroplane, a few cars, doors being closed, and a woman ordering someone to stop it. I think this part of the test is for Optimod, but I'm not sure. Keep up the good work, says James Robinson, and thanks for the close listening to the classic FM bird noises. And Ralph Bradley's sent us a tape of them, and also the announcement, so rather than me read out all the frequencies, I'll let the tape do it. Ralph is in South Gosforth in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and he gives the schedule for Radio Japan, presumably in English, from 0500 to 0600 UTC on 9695 and 9770, and from 0700 to 0800 it's 9670 and 9770, and from 2300 to 2400 it's 6025 and 6160 kilohertz. That's from Skelton in Britain. So here's Ralph's classic FM tape.
In preparation for the new independent national radio service, Classic FM. Tests are being carried out on transmitters at 11 sites across the United Kingdom. These tests are liable to interruptions and may be at reduced power from time to time. Audio alignment tones are also included in these tests, and you are therefore advised not to listen at high volume levels. Classic FM's transmitters will provide coverage to most of the United Kingdom population, and will broadcast on frequencies between 99.9 MHz and 101.9 MHz in the VHF FM band. The initial network of 11 transmitters will be supplemented by further transmitters to increase coverage. All transmissions will be in stereo, and signal polarization is mixed. A radio data service, RDS, is also being transmitted. This is an engineering test transmission in preparation for the new independent national radio service, Classic FM. Transmitters are being tested for the following locations at these nominated frequencies. London and the South East, reference TQ595604, 100.9 MHz. Central Scotland, reference NS828647, 101.7 MHz. Northern Ireland, reference J286750, 101.9 MHz. South Wales and the West, reference ST110742, 101.7 MHz. The North and Northwest of England, reference SE095041, 101.1 MHz. Northeast England, reference NZ148526, 100.3 MHz. The Midlands, reference SK113003, 100.1 MHz. The South Midlands and Central Southern England, reference SP567105, 101.3 MHz. The Southeast Midlands, reference TL127913, 101.9 MHz. East Anglia, reference TM131958, 101.5 MHz. The South of England, reference SZ447865, 100.3 MHz.
A small item in the Guardian diary. Being flagrantly Irish is, as we know, a pretty serious matter in the eyes of the law. Driving about, somewhat lost in the dark byways of Yorkshire, especially when the police are on the alert for suspected terrorists, as they were recently, compounds the problem. In no time at all, Brian O'Connell was tailed, then stopped. Irish, eh? It was almost inevitable that Mr. O'Connell would end up in A, difficulties with the constabulary, B, handcuffs, and C, choky. The good news is that he was quickly released. This is just as well. Mr. O'Connell is London correspondent of Radio Televisión Éireann. That's RTE, the Irish state broadcaster. A report by Andrew Moncur.
A strange postcard addressed to Sparky of a Highland homestead with a thatched roof and an aerial stuck on the top. Was hearing you fine on my wee crystal, 6205. But not now. Morag must have jogged the whisker. Hamish is working on a pedal-powered set, as in the picture. A converted spinning wheel, by the look of it. Your Reader's Digest of Tech Talk is excellent. Keep it up. Not sure if that's a compliment or not. Do you still have your magic piano? What? That's from Hilton of Fern Cottage, by Brechin Angus Tayside. Thanks for writing in and for sending the extraordinary postcard. And Jean-Yves Camus writes from Vincennes in France. This reception report is to say that reception of radio fax is good here in Paris, even with as simple a receiver as my Sangian ATS-803 with a whip antenna. I heard about your station via Shortwave News, the bulletin of the Danish Shortwave Club to which I belong. Programme content was very interesting for the shortwave enthusiast and the technically minded. I heard broadcasting and TV news from the UK, then a feature about sound effects and media scientific and technical news, and a review of the World DX Club bulletin. You had an ad for the shortwave car radio mentioned in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list, that's the DC777, which I've been asked to translate into French for the Club Amateur Radio, a French-speaking DX club in Paris. The selection of out-of-band frequencies is, I think, a smart choice, especially in the 75-metre band 3910. Although the noise there is inferior to that in the 48-metre band in an urban area such as mine, I shall appreciate receiving your schedule and shall stay tuned to Radio Fax, which is one of the most enjoyable free radio stations I've heard for a long time, the strong signal level making it even more pleasant to listen to. Thanks for that, Jean-Yves Camus in France. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, Britain's number 2 shortwave station, 6205 3910 and 12255. And here's some more background into the mysterious bird song that's recently been on FM. You've probably worked out it's a test transmission for Classic FM, but in The Observer there's some more information about it by Richard Brooks. This pleasant countryside muzak has led to letters and phone calls to the radio authority, mainly from what the authority quaintly calls anoraks. These radio freaks, the wireless equivalent of train spotters, get their name from the type of coats they usually wear. Some are simple queries of the what's this or how restful variety, but a few are annoyed that it interrupts listening, in the south and east at least, to the dance music station Kiss FM. Kiss FM is only meant to be heard within the M25 area, yet people in Northamptonshire and Hampshire have complained that the bird song has ruined listening to the hip-hop house and reggae. One man even taped the bird song from the radio and then recorded some nightingales in his neighbourhood. He wrote to the radio authority saying he had played back his track in the garden for the birds, particularly the nightingales, to reply in chorus. But what are these rural radio sounds? The answer lies not so much in the soil, but in the test transmissions for Britain's first national commercial radio station, Classic FM, which comes on air in September. Setting up a national FM station is complex, as it needs 11 large transmitters and at least another 11 small ones to reach most of the country. Usually test transmissions put out tone noise, but Classic's consulting engineer Quentin Howard had a different idea: countryside sounds. It's nicer, says Howard, who is also programme director for GWR. So 10 out of 10 to James Robinson, who early in the programme pointed out that the person reading it out was from GWR. the local commercial station in the West Country. GWR is a shareholder in Classic. Howard had recorded birdsong and rural sounds a couple of years ago for his amateur dramatics society, which was putting on Raymond Briggs' When the Wind Blows. I hung my tape recorder mic outside my bedroom window. A few weeks ago, he remembered the tape and then transferred it, adding some sheep from a sound effects record onto a compact disc, which is now being played round the country. Really keen listeners can discover the Classic connection, as every 30 minutes, Howard's voice briefly announces that the station tests are for the new station. Even so, the bird sounds have excited not only the anoraks, but also the ornithologists, or twitchers as they're known. Many have phoned or written to Classic FM or the Radio Authority, guessing not only what the birds are, but the time of year of the recording and part of the country. Most of the twitchers are uncannily correct, says Quentin Howard. They have tended to suggest the autumn. It's the crow sound that gives that away, and the West Country. But Howard is determined not to reveal the precise spot. I want people to guess, he says. Classic FM's rural ruse is part of a pattern, since it doesn't want to give away the type of classical music it will play. That would offer clues to Radio 3, which this week announces new programme plans, and it's also paid off, getting them a page 3 article in The Observer as a bit of a publicity stunt. Well done to Quentin Howard, who's also a regular writer for International Broadcasting.
World at One looked at the future of ITV, starting with Liz Howell, who is responsible for the programme company, replacing TVAM.
I think we pride ourselves on the fact that we're spending the money on the screen. With TVAM, they had the huge, if you like, white elephant of a great big building to keep up. We don't have that. the money we spend will be on the production and for the viewers' benefit.
Hello, hello. Now we're going to work on the legs again. We'll do exactly the same exercises as we did on Tuesday.
TVAM's output was often accused of being soft and undemanding. GMTV could be even softer. It's dropping TVAM's early morning business section and David Frost's political interviews and hoping to sign up Jeremy Beadle and a sex symbol health presenter. Liz Howell is unrepentant.
We are certainly populist television, but because everybody has to get up in the morning, it's a universal feeling, and I sincerely hope that we are going to press a universal button by giving people the news and information they need in a pleasantly presented way. Yes, there will be fun elements and populist elements and silly elements, and no doubt there will be elements that go horribly wrong, but overall we're trying to aim for something which most people will like.
From next year, ITV will be competing head-on with Channel 4 for advertising, as well as the burgeoning satellite channels. Sky B has outbid it for live football from the Premier League. The companies will have fewer public service obligations and are certain to become much more commercial.
Neighbours, everybody needs good neighbours.
Roger Lawton is the man who bought Neighbours for the BBC. He now runs Meridian, the new ITV company for southern England. And like Paul Jackson, he believes the new system means all peak time programmes must get high ratings to survive. It's raised fears about the future of current affairs on ITV.
It does mean that in a competitive commercial environment, strong current affairs programmes must earn their place alongside other programmes. But I'd apply that to all areas of programming. It's going to be more competitive, and the programme makers will have to recognise it.
This week will disappear at the end of the year, a victim of Thames's loss of its licence. But some fear that serious current affairs programmes could disappear from ITV's peak time schedule altogether. Paul Jackson says if they're to command peak slots, they must increase their audiences or move.
That's not to say we won't do those programmes, because we will need to retain our overall mix of programming throughout the 24-hour period, but there's no commercial sense in thrusting those audience-losing programmes into the prime commercial time. So they will be marginalised, and I believe that audiences who want that kind of information will find them.
A report there by the BBC's media correspondent, Torin Douglas. Captain Cook, the radio pirate who refuses to walk the plank. Kim Bielenberg reporting in the Irish Independent. Despite tougher radio licensing laws, there are still 18 stations in the state. After 26 years on the airwaves, Radio Dublin is the pirate station that refuses to lie down and die. Led by its legendary boss, Captain Eamon Cook, the station that began the Dublin pirate radio boom of the 70s still has a loyal band of listeners. Broadcasting from a rundown terraced house in Inchicore, it is also causing headaches for RTE by winning a new audience abroad. Radio experts thought that the die-hard pirates would finally be sunk with the tightening up of the radio licensing laws and the arrival of new smooth-talking commercial radio stations. However, government monitors concede that there are still 18 pirate stations in the state. Despite regular raids by the Department of Communications, Captain Cook and his battle-scarred first mate Joe Doyle have refused to walk the plank. Radio Dublin occupies a slot on the FM band somewhere between Classic Hits 98 FM and FM 104. Radio Dublin is now an unashamedly middle-of-the-road and old-fashioned station. Broadcasting on 101 MHz, the low-rent pirate is close to the ratings spot Century Radio was at when it went down with many bankruptcy casualties last year. Much to the gall of RTE and the powers that be, the pirate station is now considered to be the voice of Ireland abroad. Radio Dublin manages to broadcast on shortwave, and its signal can be picked up in America and across Europe. According to Radio Dublin's station manager, Joe Doyle, many foreign listeners think the Captain's station is the Dublin equivalent of Radio Moscow or the BBC World Service. Joe Doyle says, "We get letters from all over. We are particularly popular in Canada, Italy and Switzerland. Listenership in such places as Armenia and Lithuania has shot up since the unjamming of capitalist radio stations in former communist countries. Whether they are tuning in from Warsaw or Walkinstown, the dedicated listeners hear a mixture of easy listening tunes, short news items and advertisements for motor repair shops or hairdressing salons in the Inchicore area. In days gone by, Dave Fanning, Marty Whelan and Ian Dempsey have learned their trade on board the captain's ship.
As a result of its international broadcasts, the Terraced House in Inchicore has become one of Dublin's less publicised tourist attractions. We have a steady stream of foreign visitors, especially in the summer, and the taxi drivers know where we are, said the captain. Radio Dublin is not the only pirate operating in the capital. Run by the Daly family from their home in Cabinteely, DLR FM is attracting thousands of listeners with music aimed at a much younger audience. That's Dunleary Local Radio. You may hear them on 6220 at weekends occasionally. There are four other regular pirates operating outside Dublin, KLAS and Star Country in Monaghan, and Riverside and North Atlantic in Donegal. If stations that go on air intermittently are included, the government estimates that there are a total of 18. Stations have been raided or fined as a result of court actions, and some are due to be prosecuted, but none of the measures seem to have much effect. The government has warned advertisers through advertisements in local newspapers and by personal letter that they are liable to prosecution if they advertise on the pirates. Kim Bielenberg's report there, published in Ireland.
And in London, Paul Charman reports in the Evening Standards, 30 outlaw stations lure a million listeners, the pirates' new wave. An unprecedented boom in pirate radio has hit London, with a record 30 illegal stations now battling for space on the FM band. An estimated million young Londoners in the southeast tune in to the ceaseless diet of new wave dance music and advertisements for a growing number of rave parties. The cult style of the pirate disc jockeys can be baffling to the uninitiated. Energy blowing you up, oh yeah, drawls the DJ on Touchdown Radio, broadcasting from a makeshift studio off Holloway Road in North London. Catch TC at the top of the hour, Hooligan at two. One refrain is shouts, pirate radio speak for a dedication to Brenda on the Abbey Estate, and that's coming from her secret admirer. Although a million miles from the BBC, Touchdown on 94, pretty hardcore, sits within a whisker of Radio 4. The slightest touch of the dial can send the unsuspecting listener cascading from the reassuring tones of File on 4 into a cacophony of techno music, where mixes last for 25 minutes, and the effect is of a cross between a dustbin bouncing down a fire escape and the reception one might get if your TV aerial was struck by lightning. The pirates' call signs Touchdown, Chillin', Deflection, Hardcore, Rush and Pulse are not only new buzzwords on the street, but give out information on all-night raves or house parties, where drugs like LSD, amphetamines and ecstasy are sold as prerequisites for staying the course, with tickets ranging from £10 to £25 a head, and draws of 3,000 ravers common, today's pirate radio scene is big business. It's not the drugs or the money that concerns the men at the DTI's Radio Investigation Service, which last year carried out 250 raids on London pirates alone. They secured 72 prosecutions under the new Broadcasting Act, which provides for stiffer penalties of a maximum of 6 months' jail and unlimited fines. It's not the case that we want to be killjoys, said Barry Maxwell, head of the 150-strong RIS, but there are examples where pirates cause serious interference to emergency service frequencies, the most serious being with aircraft. They use cheap and nasty transmitters with signals which spill over into other wave bands, fouling up the frequencies of the police, fire brigade and ambulance. Although two new commercial radio licenses a month are advertised throughout the country, no new licenses are planned in London. Once the next franchise round is over in October, we will have to sit back and work out whether London needs any more radio stations, it said. But the pirates are not prepared to wait that long. One of the most established and community-minded is Station FM, run by black disc jockey and reformed drug addict DJ Keith Lee, who won the British Reggae Industries Award for the Best Radio DJ Personality Community last year. The station's 40-mile signal can be picked up in Southend and Luton. We're a community station set up with a backing from the community, insists Keith Lee. We can't wait for the radio authority to decide what's needed. There's a demand out there now, and we're serving it. Like everybody else, we get raided on average four times a week, but the officials take only the rig, the aerial which relays a signal from the pirates' station. We can be back on the air within hours, says Keith Lee. Well, it can't be quite four times a week, because if you work that out, that would be 200 times just for Station FM, and the DTI higher up in the article said they'd done 250 raids on London pirates. But I'm sure they get raided quite a lot. And Barry Maxwell saying they use cheap and nasty transmitters. Well, if they know they're going to be raided multiple times a week, they're not going to go in for high quality ones. It's quite possible to use a high quality pirate transmitter, and many stations out in the not out of the London area use better quality transmitters, I would think. So it's fine for him to say they use nasty transmitters, but that's partly due to the DTI. And the Evening Standard has also got the listening figures for the London area, with Capital Radio on 32%, Radio 1 29%, Radio 2 22%, Radio 3 9%, Radio 4 26%, Radio 5 a pathetic 8%, BBC Local Radio, that's GLR etc., 10%, Jazz FM 6%, Kiss FM 11%, LBC 13%, which is pretty poor as well, and Melody Radio 14%, so you can see the easy listening has now overtaken the talk. And interestingly, Radio Luxembourg 1%. It's not clear what the dates of that survey are for, whether they're since or before the station went on satellite. However, if they're before, 1% in London is still 100,000 listeners, and if you multiply that over the rest of the country, I don't see they were quite such a small proportion as everybody made out. Or is this 1% people listening on satellite, which is even more interesting? We've had a fax through from Gold Crest Broadcasting Limited, which seems to be another reincarnation of Howard Rose. And he's got a new magazine called The Radio Magazine, published every week. It's available on subscription for £60 a year. And he says, we cover the latest news, information and gossip from, for and about the radio industry. So if you're interested in that, it's telephone 0536 418 558 or fax 0536 418 539. Or you can write to Goldcrest Broadcasting, Crown House, 25 High Street, Rothwell, Northamptonshire, NN14 2BB, and you can ask for a sample issue. Andrew Priest has written in, saying, enclosed is a free local paper cutting from Glasgow. In my last letter, I mentioned that none of the pirate stations in Paisley have been on recently. Well, Chaos FM were on shortly after that, but not much. So, in the Glaswegian, Angela Dewar reports, Radio Clyde is set to become involved in another battle of the airwaves, if plans to introduce a new independent radio station go ahead. A licence for Central Scotland is expected to be announced later this year. If it does, it will be in direct competition to Clyde. For the Clydebank-based station is banned from applying to the licence because it also owns the East Coast Radio 4th. The Radio Authority has stated that the new station cannot be a replica of Clyde, but it could still steal a large number of its listeners. A spokeswoman for the Radio Authority said it could be a rock service, country or jazz, anything that's different from what's currently available. The idea is to make it similar to the situation in London, which has pop, jazz, club and ethnic stations, as well as a spoken service. The licence will go to the applicant most likely to meet the needs of people in the area, and with sufficient financial backing to sustain the 8-year running period. It could be on air by the end of next year. The spokeswoman added, like all local radio stations, there can't be a 50% overlap, so Radio Clyde can't apply for the regional licence because it already owns stations in the area. Well, there's a bigger article about Radio Clyde next week on Sparks. The article also says here, Paisley Local Radio has changed its name to 096 FM before it even goes on the air. Its signal is now expected to reach as far as the southern and western district of Glasgow, as well as as Eastwood and the north banks of the Clyde. The station will be heard by 750,000 listeners, almost three times the number of first estimates. Station head Jerry Grant said, "We know there's a keen and supportive listening public out there in a busy marketplace, which will welcome an imaginative and entertaining radio station. We're going to be music-led. I look forward to receiving your letter on Sparks. The address is Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.